It's time for the Access of Easy podcast, the weekly technology digest that keeps you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by EasyDNS.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Access of Easy, the latest and greatest in data breach and overreach. And my name is Joey. That's Len. It's Thursday night. It's hot as hell outside.
It's nice.
It's a little sticky, I would say, for my taste. But nice. I'm not going to complain too much because 90 days from now, we'll be doing this show and complaining that it's getting cold. So
in 30 days, I'll be complaining it's getting cold.
You think? August?
Yeah. No, we're on August right now. September, I'm already gearing up for winter, and I'm wishing it for the next summer. Because by September it turns to night around 7:30.
Yeah.
So you could, in the latter half of the month. So I'm kind of wishing it was the earlier time of the year where, light until 9 change. It's beautiful in like June and July. I'm already missing summer, even though we're already in it. I'm actually going to go to a place where it's going to be eternal spring or eternal summer. That's the goal. I will get there. It's going to take some time for me to get there. That's the problem. A few more years before I'm finally there. Been in my mind.
It's going to take me longer than it takes you. Anyway, doesn't matter. We're both going to retire to a nice villa somewhere, I think.
Different stages of our lives, right? I'm 10 years older than you, so we'll see. If Bitcoin rips, maybe you go before me. Who knows? Family more than anything is keeping me here.
Maybe I gotta think about it.
I can tell you right now.
Yeah, but don't you have roots? My wife loves the little town we live in, and so she doesn't want to move. I don't know what the Bitcoin price would have to be to convince her to go, but it'd have to be significantly higher than what it is now.
Well, there's been a lot of changes in the things that we see, enough that is causing people in this household to make decisions or think about what's going to happen moving forward. Again, if I had no family, there's a very good possibility I would already be gone.
Yeah.
I have enough that I could survive somewhere else and be very good at, live a very good life, I think. But whatever, Joey, I'm stuck here for the time being. I hate the cold. I hate the winters and other things I despise. But
here we are doing Access of Easy again. We got some great stories this week. Yeah, it's shorter than usual this week, I think. Although we have about the same amount of stories, and there's one CBP story, which is great. So let's get started.
NBA Jam stories though.
No NBA Jam hacks this week. Last week's quote: "Don't worry about people stealing your ideas. If your ideas are any good, you'll have to ram them down people's throats." That was by Howard Aiken. No one got that. So this week's quote: "We know they're lying. They know they're lying. They know that we know they are lying. We also know that they know that we know they're lying, but still they lie." Who's that by?
William T. Riker.
I don't know, but if you know, put it in the comment section. You know the rules. No looking. Don't Google it. Okay. Be fair. Be honest. And if you're right, you get your next round of renewals on EasyDNS. That's a great quote for these times we find ourselves in, Len. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stories. Where do you want to start, my friend?
This new Google vulnerability in the Google workspace, that's something that's interesting. It essentially, this allowed hackers to bypass the email verification and create workspace accounts. And this is done without domain verification. So really what then happened is attackers were able to circumvent the email verification step by using specially constructed requests. And the vulnerability, to Google's credit, was after it was reported. They were able to fix it within 72 hours, but within those 72 hours, attackers were able to exploit the vulnerability quite a bit and potentially compromising the accounts of many, many users. So the attackers were able to use these accounts to access third-party services like the sign-in with Google. And this gave access for these hackers to a variety of sensitive information, including personal data, financial information, and business data. Think of all the people out there that use that sign in with Google or sign in with Apple or whatever as a simple way of just doing things. And well, if you're able to get access to it, you open up all these doors to this. So really, the attackers could use the unauthorized workspace to gain access to something like Dropbox. A lot of people use Dropbox. It's a cloud-based service, but still, how many people use that or other things like that to store personal or sensitive information. Probably quite a lot of people out there, but more than anything, people out there, they need to be concerned, but also vigilant, and they have to see if there's anything out of the ordinary going on with their accounts, any sort of access, anything that just seems odd with all of their accounts. So you probably have to go through where you have the personal and sensitive information to see if anything is going crazy over there. And at the same time, also use the same tactics as always: strong passwords, two-factor authentication, also not clicking on emails, links in emails or messages like that. Yeah. So really, it's too bad. A lot of people were impacted, but like I said, to Google's credit, they fixed it rather fast. But you know what? 72 hours is quite a long time, and a lot of damage was done, it looks like.
Long time when you have access to stuff like one reader who gave up access to his Dropbox account. You and me operate in the Bitcoin and, dare I say, like crypto ecosystem sort of with the other show. How many stories over the years have we heard about people using LastPass or Dropbox or whatever to store their keys and having their keys yanked by hackers or vulnerabilities like this that, you know, even though Google patches them pretty quickly, you only need to look at the set of keys once and save that file once and you're done. There's no going back. Banking information, same story. You know, you get that information, you're cooked. You know, they're into your lines of credit, they're into your credit cards, they're into your finances in a way that nobody wants to be exposed. I think now, Len, the other thing I would note too is, you know, if I think about the Google services I use, one of them that I'm trying to get away from actually, and I was working on getting away from it a bit today, is photos. And it's going to be so much more important for people to secure photos that they take of their kids, their pets, things of this nature. And I'll tell you why. Two reasons. One is that, you know, I don't know about you, but I know that in the past, you know, you get prompted sometimes to use passwords that you'll know and be familiar with. And one of the things I think people lean on, I know this because I used to do it. You know, you can try and get me with this now, but you won't have any success. One of the things I used to do was use like names of pets, right? And even still today, if you look at like stuff like secret questions and whatnot, it asks you, you know, what's your pet's name, first home address, first whatever. This information is hard to find for someone who doesn't know you or know enough about you to have that, you know, some kind of third party hacker. But in Google Photos, Len, do you know what comes up at the top of the Google Photos tab on your phone, in your browser, and all that stuff?
Family and pets?
Family and pets with names. And so, it, you know, if I look at my Google Photos, it has like, you know, my wife's first name, my dog's first name, my cousins, my father, my grandfather, deceased relative, like anyone who you've ever like taken a picture of, it knows through your keystrokes who that person is. That's one problem for password related stuff. Number two, you know, isn't it worrisome that AI gets a hold of these photos and suddenly there's like a photorealistic video of a child of yours, a relative of yours, whatever, making a phone call or doing a video message for you or whatever, asking for something, demanding money, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's so much more important than people realize. Dropbox used to be just a place to stash PDFs that you didn't want to store on your laptop or you wanted to move from your home to your office or whatever. It still is that for a lot of people, but it's so much more for many people as well. And as technology around this stuff advances and the vulnerabilities become more significant in terms of the surface area, you can use something as simple as a picture of a pet or a picture of a kid for this becomes so much more important. I'm guilty of using this sign in from Google and Apple thing all the time. I do this often, more often than I care to admit. And, you know, reading the story earlier, I thought maybe I should think more about this. You know, is it worth really narrowing down, number one, the number of services I use so that I'm not tempted to use this? And number two, is it worth coming up with, you know, a way that's more reliable to stash passwords as opposed to just continuing to use my Google or Apple account? Maybe, you know, this stories like this are scary now, but in 5 or 6 years, the data that's in these places is going to be so much more potent in terms of ways to destroy your life and make things difficult for you. It's just very, very important to secure things that you thought maybe were of less consequence, you know, only a few years ago.
Just, I don't know about you. Like, for example, if somebody were to get access to my phone and get total access to it, there's not much that they could really get from me. There's no money they could take from me. They're like, they're stuck. Like, there's going to be a dead end. And same with my computer. Like, there's, you know what? I'm I've finally come to a point, a lot of garbage has been wiped off, that even if they get access, like just physical access to stuff that I have, like that I'm using right now, like my computer, for instance, I'm fine.
The email is enough. The email is enough, right? It's the big thing is if they get access to your email account.
Because what could they get from that?
Password, they could go anywhere. Anywhere you've used that email to sign up for something and you can reset a password, they can get it. That's the trick, right? So that's the big thing.
The most important thing to me right now is my Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right? And there is zero evidence of any Bitcoin on all of my devices. Right. Nothing. So with...
Yeah, they can never get that. Everything else you can recoup, right? Through different processes and whatever.
I don't even have my banking information.
As long as they don't know where you bank and you have like nothing on your phone at all, that would give them a cookie crumb. But you know, I think a lot of people do. I'm guilty of this again, maybe as a product of our age gap here, but you know, a lot of my friends are similar, and I would guess kids that are younger than me are even worse for this and even more careless with stuff like banking information. It's a clear sort of shift in thinking that people need to make about their security, because we've really, and you've mentioned this a number of times on this show and on Canadian Bitcoiners podcast too, there's been a clear shift toward convenience, a sort of the sacrifice at the altar of convenience of security. And I think we're going to start heading back to the direction pretty soon. And there's ways to do this. Like we've talked about encryption keys before, and you know, the public private key thing is obviously big in Bitcoin, but there's other ways too. I think people are going to become more familiar with it, not because they want to, Lynn, but because it's going to become a necessity, is my guess.
At that point, it's too late if you get...
And
you have to start changing stuff because it's already there. It's already on a line somewhere, and you have to start changing it. And people are lazy for the most part. Let's talk about Meta, because there was a massive settlement that was reached by Meta, who agreed to pay the state of Texas a king's ransom of $14
billion. And this is $1.4 billion.
This is to resolve a settlement for a lawsuit alleging unauthorized collection and use of biometric data, right? So the complaint originally was filed back in 2022, so it's pretty recent, but they were accusing Meta violating something called Capture or Use of Biometric Identifier Act. Like, I had never heard of this thing. This thing is just, it's specific to Texas, I'm thinking, the state of Texas. So it doesn't apply to... Anyways, the gist around the lawsuit centered around Facebook. They had a feature known as tag suggestions, and this was introduced back in 2011, some 13 years ago. And the feature used facial recognition technology to identify users in photos.
Does this not sound like what I just said?
This has been in use for some time, 2011. Think about how much more advanced it's gotten since then.
Yeah.
And it was identifying users and suggesting tagging them. So this lawsuit, according to it, Meta captured biometric data, including facial templates from over 20 million Texans without their consent. So the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, he's been a vocal critic of Meta for their data practices, and I think he's been wanting to nail them on the cross for quite some time, and he finally got the chance to do so. So what I'm trying to look at this is, this applies to Texas, but are there similar laws outside of Texas and also in other countries? Because if not, then this type of activity is probably still going on, and there's going to be no slap on the wrist that's going to be accompanying them doing this practice. They're taking your information. They have recognized who you are. They have some sort of facial recognition. That information, they could use that and in many ways moving forward, especially as you mentioned, as AI gets more advanced. And if somebody was able to use that as a way to go against you, they can. This is pretty damning stuff. It's too bad that they've been doing it for so long, and how many people have been using Facebook and just freely giving up all information, where they're located, what they're thinking, and pictures alongside it. And it's easy for them to start collecting data on individuals. When a product is free, you are the product. This is another example of it.
Vanity is a hell of a drug, and I can't figure out why any sane person would still have a Facebook account, number one. Number two, you know, even as I, you know, God willing, enter into fatherhood here in the next few months, I see a lot of people who post a lot of pictures of their children on Instagram. And I would assume Facebook too, although I don't, you know, use the Blue app. I can't figure out why you would do that, knowing that you're basically giving these tech companies, and it's not just Facebook and Google, it's all of them. Snapchat probably does it too. I mean, I think all these guys do. You're giving them a fingerprint for, you know, giving them a fingerprint for your online avatar almost, right? Like, you know, if I get tagged in enough photos at bars, eventually I'll start to be tagged or targeted by bar ads, targeted by booze ads, targeted by blah, blah, blah. And that, you know, as advertising technology becomes more and more effective and more soulless, you know, could you influence the life of somebody in that way? You know, it's one thing for us, I say us, me for sure. It didn't really start for me until I was probably 22 or 23. This sort of, you know, data is the new oil, and if the product is free, you're the product conundrum. But for a lot of these people now who are posting pictures of their kids, it's going to start for their children when they're 4 and 5. These same kids are going to have their own tablets around the house. They're going to be subjected to certain YouTube algo videos and stuff like that, all because of biometric identifiers like this. You can't convince me that there's any other outcome here. And I think it's irresponsible to put pictures of, you know, anybody who is not, let's say, an autonomous actor on the internet, because it really does endanger them long term. And I'm thinking specifically about kids here, but I mean, there's other applications of this as well, I'm sure. It's not good. 1.4 billion is a lot, but it's not a lot for Meta. And I bet, Len, that over the course of the 11 or 12 years, or I guess 13 years at this point, God, I still think it's 2020. The 13 years at this point, since they've rolled this tag suggestions thing out, I think they've made more than 1.4 billion in terms of, you know, sales of this data, use of this data, money they've made from advertisers, given that advertisers will have access to this data, stuff like that. I bet you this fine is significantly lower a sum than what they've pulled in. Don't forget, they bought Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion in like 2011. So it's around the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really the profits that you're trying to look at here. Is it, did they make that much in profit? If so, then obviously it was a total net gain for them.
Yeah.
And the books are open. You can see how much they made. Look at how much the company's worth, the valuation of it.
I know.
It's massive. And just, I mean, going into the weeds here, whatever happened to that whole metaverse thing that they were trying to pump up?
Memory hold. It's getting memory hold as we speak.
This is about 2 years ago, right? It became prompt. They changed your name. And
yeah,
man, what a disaster that turned out to be. Anyways, it is being memory hold.
They did end up, they ended up keeping the name though. I totally forgot about that. I just like, it worked on me. I was distracted. I can't believe that. I totally forgot. Remember the Zuckerberg presentation where he was like a floating head on a little fake cartoon body? That was so bad. So bad. They burned like a quarter of their enterprise value, basically trying to make that work between the money they spent on it and the stock price diving. But they did recover.
I'm surprised it recovered.
Yeah, credit to Zuck on that. They did manage to get it all back plus more. I mean, part of that was just inflationary pressure, but you know, still.
Well, picking, like, even including that into the whole equation, they've done a magnificent job resurrecting the company. Maybe not resurrecting, turning it around.
Yeah,
because it was heading in the wrong direction very quickly, and here they are. Their valuation is still very high. I wouldn't expect it to be the case.
Are they 2 trillion?
No.
Let me see.
No, I think that's a very
1.2 trillion.
Yeah. I think the 2 trillion club is extremely select.
Apple, Nvidia, Amazon, maybe?
That Saudi company, too. What the fuck's
Aramco,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. OpenAI. Have you heard about this?
Welcome back to OpenAI Hour on Access of Easy.
Well, Search GPT, I've never heard about this thing before.
Me neither.
But here they are. Well, Google's monopoly on this internet search engine. It looks like it may be coming to an end if the people behind this new AI search engine get their way. And the new search engine is called Search GPT. And they want to try giving Google a run for their money. And so the theory behind this is that AI can enhance the user experience by providing more relevant and personalized search results. And the people behind this project, they argue that the potential of AI can revolutionize e-commerce by facilitating product discovery and enabling more engaging customer interaction.
What have you ever heard any more like Orwellian doublespeak than that? Product discovery. It's just target. It's just another way to say targeted ads. Like, well, or what are these guys doing? What are they talking? Who believes this? Who wrote that?
Let's put away this talk and just talk about the nitty gritty here. Google has a huge advantage. There's a reason why nobody has been able to chip away at their dominance in the search field, the search engine situation, because they are really good at trolling, gathering, and distributing that information to people who want to see it, and they'll distribute what information they want to share too. Maybe they could even change the way the results look, but either way, topic for another time. On top of that, there's also an uphill battle these guys have to fight for transparency and dealing with regulations, because they'll have to address, I guess, the concerns about misinformation and bias. So this search GPT, not only do they have to deal with that aspect, but they then have to try to slay this absolute monster. Now, I've mentioned it many times, this AI stuff, it is a advanced version of searching. And granted, they're trying to use that into the product they're trying to push out to us. But the reality is, I'm not sure people are going to go to the search GPT in place of Google. Think about iPhones, Android phones. A lot of them default to Google.
Yeah.
And people don't change them for whatever reason. So that is a huge moat that they have built up, and it's going to be virtually impossible to basically chip away at it. Not to say that it is impossible, but it's just going to be a large uphill battle. I give these guys credit for trying, but I if they ended up failing and then, you know, a year from now we hear that they scrapped this project, I'm not going to be knocked over by a feather. It's just going to be like, whatever, another project that tried to go after Google, and this is pretty much expected.
Isn't the sort of twisted irony here that Microsoft, who is the target of basically every antitrust lawsuit ever over its bundling practices, isn't Microsoft now, since they're sort of an OpenAI partner, owner, whatever the relationship is, don't they have a case against the browsers all using Google as a search engine and doing it by default, and, you know, enforcing an opt-out instead of an opt-in? That was always the case people made against Microsoft in the lead up to its dominance as far as Windows and IE, and now Edge, I guess. You've seen this with Teams as well. Teams famously sort of bundled in some Windows Enterprise packages now and just destroys Slack, Google, Workspace, all this stuff. I don't know if it's an antitrust, you know, winner, but it's in the same vein. I'd be curious. We need to have a legal scholar on to talk about that. I'm not going to get too far into that. As far as the disruptive case for search GPT, 0 out of 5 on that name, by the way, it really has to be 10 times better than Google search. And because of the regulatory capture, like, I don't know, there's a more accurate way to put it, but I don't want to, upset the powers that be here, because I would use some more pointed language. But clearly it's hard to be 10 times better than Google as far as search, because search is about results, and results are governed by these insane sort of misinformation, disinformation guidelines, right? And laws that really are just like, you know, they censor stories that the regime doesn't like. That's really the sort of period end of story summary. How are you going to be 10 times better? You can only really be 10 times better than from a UI experience. And ChatGPT is not that good from a UI point of view. Worse, you know, if I think about the mobile experience, if I go to ChatGPT and want to search the web, it's going to have to link me at some point to a browser window. And so what browser am I going to go to?
Chrome, probably. And
what did we say? What did we say the market share of Chrome was? Like 75% or something last time we talked about this? So is ChatGPT really going to send you out to Chrome and then Google's just going to carry the water for them? No, Google's not going to carry the water for them when it goes back out to Chrome. They're going to go back to Google services. And so this is, I think, an uphill battle for a lot of reasons, not least among them the moat that Google has as far as the browser. The browser itself is just like really pour hot cold water on this. But you add into the equation all this other stuff, and the fact that you and me both agree, I think, that this is not really that good a product at the retail level. Maybe enterprise is better, GPT, I'm not sure, but at the retail level, it's just not that good. So I don't see a lot of people going for this. And it looks like, I'll just add here, it seems to me that OpenAI tries to cater to what it believes is its power user group. Power users don't have patience and don't want to leave systems that allowed them to become power users in the first place. That seems to me to be the hardest group to pull off of an existing set of services or products. Why wouldn't you start with the retail user and try and gain momentum that way? That's something I've never been able to figure out about this strategy. And GPT or OpenAI seems to not understand this. And I can't figure out why, unless I'm missing something, but I really can't figure out why they're trying to get the people who are most reliant on understanding the service and suite of services they use in the workflow that's, you know, making them money. Why would they ever leave it? It doesn't add up. I think that's a poor strategy from OpenAI.
Well, let's see what happens moving forward, because they have a lot of big money backing them. So yeah, they could easily sustain what they're doing right now and potentially just capture another company and build it within their product. So who knows? I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here, but Google, they're not moving for
monolith.
Some time.
Yeah, monolith.
They are. So let's talk about this guy, Jonathan Turley. And this is he's an attorney and scholar and everything. But anyways, he wrote a piece. I can't believe closing to the end of 2024, and we were talking about this. It's about Elon Musk and buying up Twitter, because he's talking about this Mr. Turley that Musk wants less censorship on the platform. Okay. Free speech is very important, and it shouldn't be limited by social media companies. And that's a good point. But he agrees that these are good ideas, but he's also saying that reducing the content moderation too much could allow for hate speech, misinformation, harmful content to be spread easily. And there's an argument to be made for a balanced approach to content moderation. I just want to say, Musk bought it, what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? Like, this has been quite some time that he purchased it. And obviously he's been doing with Twitter/X since he bought it, to open it up and make it less moderated and more open speech, more free speech on there. Why is this guy Turley talking about this now? It's an election year. Is that why? Like, there's, it just seems like this has been a great discussion to have a year ago, year and a half ago, but 2024, like, come on, like, why bring this up now? Like, the horse has left the barn. All you're really doing is just seeing it like sour grapes at this point. You're just pissed off the fact that this social media platform is opened up more so than it was in years past. It has to be tied to an election.
Right? I don't think that's why he's mad. I think he's mad. So he writes this article, critical of friend of the show, NewsGuard. Remember NewsGuard?
No, I don't.
NewsGuard is this like organization that basically rates, news information websites for credibility. And, you know, the problem we had with NewsGuard when we talked about them in the past.
Oh, these are the global disinformation index.
Yeah, it's part of it, right? And so, and this is the reason why the Axios VZ newsletter uses this title, censorship under the guise of credibility. And Turley, he's a law professor, basically wrote this article critical of NewsGuard. And, a week later, NewsGuard sends him an email and says, yeah, by the way, Mr. Turley, we're going to actually add a rating to your blog now, after you've written this thing about us. Well, you can get how that's going to go. You can guess how that's going to go. Whether he thinks that NewsGuard is overtly liberal, overtly state-run, I don't know. I'll give you some information here about NewsGuard that I think is relevant, because I don't think we talked about it in this much depth last time. When we talked about it, it was just sort of it was still in its fetal stages, but now it's crowning a little bit here. This is from Wikipedia. NewsGuard is based in New York City. Its advisors include former officials such as Tom Ridge, who's the former Homeland Security Secretary, Richard Stengel, former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, Michael Hayden, former CIA Director, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former NATO Chief. You may recognize that name, Rasmussen, from another tool of an election of election season, as well as Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. NewsGuard approved sites include the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and BuzzFeed. Sites it lists as unreliable include Breitbart, InfoWars, The Daily Kos, Sputnik, RT, WikiLeaks, Fox News, Epoch Times, and Leading Report. To list WikiLeaks as an unreliable source of information is wrong. WikiLeaks is primary source information. It's leaked cables, it's documents, it's, you know, stuff that will land you in jail in some cases or force you into exile in others. So, Turley writes this article and talks about how NewsGuard now is making these bizarre inquiries, including why I called my blog Res Ipsa Liquitur. The thing itself speaks is, I guess it's Latin. Could you explain the reason to this non-lawyer? Insane. Why do they care? Here's an interesting comment from their letter to Mr. Turley. I cannot find any information on the site that would signal to readers that the site's content reflects conservative or libertarian perspective, as is evident in your articles. Why is this perspective not disclosed to give your readers a sense of the site's point of view? Do you think that it asked some of its approved sources, like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or BuzzFeed, to list their political slant on their homepage?
No, never.
Of course not.
But the fact that they don't doesn't change anything. Everybody,
it doesn't change it. The point is that this is now trying to establish itself, this NewsGuard thing, trying to establish itself as judge, jury, and executioner for what information is fair or not fair. And to your earlier point in the Google story, what information will show up in a search result? And you can't have only the New York Times and BuzzFeed showing up in search results. Well, Turley's blog, our website, Mark's website, you know, are blocked because we didn't play ball. We didn't list that we're libertarian. I don't see anywhere on the New York Times that they're left of Karl Marx, but, you know, that's where they sit. And so, well, whatever, you know, those are my words, not yours, but it's an exaggeration, but the point still stands. There is no flag, you know, or anything like that on the New York Times website that indicates where they are on the political spectrum, because they're approved media. And this is another example, and we'll talk about this in the last story, of the regime doing everything it can to bump, bolster, and support the corpse of the dying media regime so that they're not losing their grip on information control. I don't see how you could do this any other way. Turley is one casualty, and this is a good article. I recommend people read it. The comments on this are bright. And honestly, Len, I didn't know who John Turley was before this. I might add him to my list of, like, you know, frequently read stuff and try and get him on CBP to talk about this.
Oh.
Yeah. I think the guy is, like, really sharp. And this is it's frustrating to me. This is one of the reasons. I mean, we'll talk about this in the last story. This is one of the reasons I wanted to bring on Dr. Geist to our other show, because people don't realize this stuff is happening because they don't pay attention to it. But soon, the only results you'll get when you search the internet will be stuff that the state approves. It's already close to that now. And it's going to be sanctioned, law, you know, legislated, that you're only going to see certain things from now on. And Turley is the canary in the coal mine for stuff like this. You posted something that the regime didn't like. Well, guess what? Now we're giving your site a rating, and it's not going to be a good one. That's insane.
Stuff like Nostr, which is truly decentralized, and it's impossible to control what message is being posted on there. That's why it's very important. And building upon that and promoting it is a big thing. We should continue to do that. And it's not to say that Twitter is something we should be trashing right now, but who knows? I mean, because it's centralized, they can control whatever narrative they want, and can't do that on Nostr.
Mm.
That's the beauty of it. So I would always recommend people try it. Yeah, it's not polished and it's very rough around the edges and it's hard to find information at times, but you got to take the good with the bad or the bad with the good. And you have to understand it's still very early on in its lifespan and there's lots of growth and the user experience is going to be growing tremendously. It's going to get a lot better. So I always recommend Nostr. That's one way to get around all this, is to decentralize where you get your information. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, it's impossible to control it.
Yeah, I agree.
Michael Geist.
Yep.
We'll talk about him. So he's talking about the impact of a few things. Bill S210, and that's the Canadian government bill that's aimed to force tech companies to pay news outlets for their content. Now, Bill S210, it's passed the Senate.
Bill S210 is not that one. Bill S210 is the...
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, Bill I can do this one because this was about...
That's in the Senate. Like, do you know where that is right now? Like, it's passed the Senate. It's in the House of Commons.
Yep.
It's in committee right now.
Yep.
And so this is something that could potentially become actual law because of how far advanced it is. The Senate is probably going to be the harder of the two to pass, and it's already done that. It's just in the second reading is done. It's now a committee. So it's very close to go for final reading and then become real set. But over to you, Joey.
This is, I want to thank Mark for putting this in the newsletter this week, because this was an interview we did with Michael, Dr. Geis, I should say, last week or 2 weeks ago at this point, I think last week. And, you know, I really wanted to talk to him, like I mentioned, because I think a lot of this stuff is happening behind the scenes. And he is a, you know, one of the last great academics, I think, you know, and I made a point of trying to call him Dr. Geis as often as I could remember to during the show, because I think that's a level of respect he's earned with his work and with his voice.
Dr. Saifedean is another one of the
greatest. Dr. Saifedean is another one. Yeah. So when I was talking to Dr. Geis, I asked him about three pieces of legislation: Bill S210, the Online News Act, and the Online Streaming Act. And the reason I chose these three is because I think these are the ones that are going to most intensely change the way that you and I and every other Canadian interacts with information on the internet, which is really the only place you interact with information at this point. S210 is the Online ID Act that's meant to quote unquote protect, you know, children from accessing pornography. I think that's a veiled, very thinly veiled attempt to identify everyone on the internet and where they're going for information, to your point earlier about whether or not, you know, we can look for decentralized news sources. There is a chance, I think, that in the next 2 years, even going on Google will force you to disclose your name and identification metrics to some third-party service that's affiliated with the Canadian government. I expect that to be the case, which is unbelievable to say, but I expect it to be the case.
Have you used Google with behind a VPN or Tor and locked your account?
Yeah.
Have you noticed how cumbersome it is to use Google?
Yeah, it's brutal. Yeah.
It's very hard to use.
I know.
There's all these checks you have to do to prove that you're not.
Yeah, it's going to be brutal then. That's brutal, and it's going to be
already
brutal
bad.
To do these things.
Already bad.
To do these things, what the S210 legislation captures, what they call are transmitters of pornographic material, and there's no lower bound threshold, which both Dr. Geis and I found to be alarming. There's no rationale, I think, as far as the intention of a website that may transmit pornography or may not. For example, the example that Dr. Geis gave to Senator Duchesne, actually, who's the origin point of this legislation, she's the private member, the senator, is that, you know, if you go on Reddit or Google or Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or Wikipedia or any website where there might be some pornographic imagery, and pornography, by the way, nearly impossible to define. The legislation has no really good definition of it, which is another issue. But the problem is that any website where you have that problem, where there's potential transmission of pornographic imagery, you have to verify your identity. And right now the plan is to do it with a third party. There's all kinds of security holes there. It's a huge issue because I don't want people knowing where I'm going on the internet. Like I said to Dr. Geis, I think you and I say things on our show that could be viewed as, less than flattering to the regime. I think he does the same on his show, Dr. Geis. I think about Mark and other podcasts. And you and me, you know, many moons ago had a gag on CBP where we changed to a webinar for a day because podcasts are going to be governed by this, you know, content moderation act that's, you know, part of this interview. So S210, lots of problems. The Online News Act is one that's in the news now because people who are using Facebook to try and share news links can't do it anymore because the Facebook team decided that they're not going to pay per click. Because again, the government tried to implement this framework they thought they could just get away with, no problem. But it turns out that the market is too small and we are basically irrelevant, save for this sort of painful proposal that has no upper limit on the number of dollars that Facebook would have to pay for clicks for Canadian news shares. Insane. I see now that some people, and this is a shout, another shout out to Dr. Geis who tweeted this today. Some people are talking about how the Canadian government should also add screenshots of news as opposed to just click through links. A level of control never exercised anywhere in the world. Screenshots of news taxed by the government. It's not feasible, and it's doubling down on poor policy, in my opinion. And then the Online Streaming Act was the last one where, the government refused to make exemptions for personal or private citizens like you and I, podcasts like CBP or Access of Easy or others, in terms of what CanCon has to come through your feed. Now, Len, the funniest thing about this is that there's actually no good definition of CanCon. I don't know if you knew that. CanCon operates on a pretty archaic point system. And I did this research leading up to the show. I don't have it in front of me now, but there's shows that are produced in Canada with all Canadian actors that don't qualify as CanCon under the current regs. And so that's a problem. Then on top of that, you have the idea that they're going to force, the government, they are going to force YouTube to promote Canadian content over other content. And so for example, if Netflix wants to operate in Canada, they have to make their algorithm objectively worse in order to suggest content that will meet this law. Well, that makes the product worse. And so you're going to get less subscriptions to Netflix that way. And, Dr. Geis brought up stuff like BBC Go. How is BBC Go going to suggest Canadian content? Well, they're going to have to produce it. And if they don't, the other part of this legislation is that all these online streamers should be paying into Canadian content, including stuff produced by the CBC. Can you imagine? It's not good. Okay, we'll say that. That's putting it softly. But also, I think it's evidence of a body of legislators who poorly understands the current state of affairs and the speed at which things are getting away from them. And I hate to draw again on sovereign individual, because we talk about it, I think, in more extreme cases than this, money and restricting capital and restricting movement. But doesn't this, have kind of the same smell? That you're really trying to bear down on the digital landscape, even though it is an impossible task. And only you seem to not know that it's an impossible task because you're so hell-bent on keeping control of, the stuff I mentioned there, identity, knowing where people are going, online news and online streaming. It's clear to me that there's a lack of understanding about what this legislation means as far as applying it, and how difficult it would be to apply it in the current sort of state of affairs. How many people would just use VPNs? Would that become criminal?
It could be. It potentially can be.
It's extremely difficult to apply this sort of thing. And I recommend people go listen to that interview. And like I said to you, Len, and like I said on Monday night, I really enjoyed talking to Dr. Geis. I'd love to talk to him again about the Online Hate Speech Act, which is another one that should be concerning to people, though not quite yet. But the thing I liked about talking to him is that he is a true expert. And I know he's an expert because people who support the legislation want his opinion. People who are against the legislation want his opinion. And guys like us who just want to share information about this for the broader public want him to do it. He can speak at any level required of him in order to make sure the message is clear. And it was an outstanding show, one of the shows I'm most proud of that we've done.
And the sad thing is the reality is two of these bills are already acts of parliament.
Yeah.
So they could potentially be repelled in the future, but right now they're laws. So we have to respect them because they are the law. The conservatives, though, I'm not sure what they're going to be doing with all three. That's what I'm. Have they talked publicly?
The conservatives want S210. Yeah.
Right. It's the only one I know for sure that they talked. Yeah. And it's funny because they're the ones that want it and the government doesn't. They've been talking negatively about it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just funny in a way, it is what it is. And what could you do? Right. Like aside from
stay humble, stack sats. What else? Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
Get out of that system.
Yeah, learn how to use Tor, learn how to use VPN as long as you're able to use it.
Yeah.
There may be laws in the future, but for the time being, there's no problems with using it. And it might give you some opportunities to get around certain things. Like, you said, like, if Netflix is now going to be changing their algorithm to provide you with Canadian content, many, for years, people have been using VPNs to get around.
Yeah.
Already. So it's not like things are going to change in that regard.
It's it's crazy. I can't imagine that. This is the other thing that we talked about on the show. Like, who's asking for this? What consumer group is asking for, you know, the Online Streaming Act? What consumer group is asking for the Online News Act? None. The people asking for it are the corpses of legacy media outfits. They need to be supported in order to survive. And the money is no longer enough. Like, the money just isn't doing it. They have to restrict access to better content through these backdoor methods. And to me, it's just a sign that, you know, we talk about this a lot on this show. The little guy always gets the short end of the stick. And this is another example of when you're going to get the short end of the stick. And the other thing too that bothers me, Len, is we're coming to a point now where I feel like young people don't know how good we used to have it in certain ways, you know?
I don't want to sound like an old guy.
Well, I just don't want to get in any trouble. But, like, you know, you and me have talked about how the country that we had even 10 years ago is gone. It's never coming back.
Everybody says that, though.
This time, you know, I hate to say
everybody. This is every generation has said that. It hasn't changed.
There's a lot of kids playing on the street at your age. A lot of kids playing on the street at my age. A lot of kids playing on the street at our parents' era. Now, Len, you see a lot of kids playing on the street. Maybe where you live. There are where I live, thankfully, still, but I don't know how long that's going to last.
Right.
Certain things have become a memory.
And you remember driving around with no, like, seatbelt?
Yes.
Okay. That's
long. I remember before, you know, I remember where a good citizen, a good working man could have a cigarette in a Tim Hortons. That's how old I am. The glass Tim Hortons smoking box.
Yeah, there's so many things that have been, they're gone.
Yeah.
But every generation's like that. Oh, young people, it's not the same as it was when we were younger. We used to have more fun. It was more natural.
Maybe it's my get off the lawn moment, but I think this one is, I think these are
pretty I've never seen anybody play stickball before. Never. Yeah. But people used to play that well before my time. So
I think these ones are pretty major.
Everything is major. I'm just trying to say that you know what? Everybody looks at it and says, you know what, things are much worse than it was now than when I was young. Every generation says that. Mm. And everybody is probably right. Is it more worse now than it was? I don't know. It's up to you to decide. Well,
it's the speed at which it's getting worse.
Money's certainly getting devalued quicker.
Yeah.
You know, the Toronto Star stock is almost at an all-time low. I'm just thinking it right now. Good. It's trading at 74 cents per share.
Needs to be at zero. Should be at zero.
The last time it was at this range was 1982, 83.
Yeah, that's good.
So it's been a long time since we've been around there. So
should be at zero. I'm looking forward to the day it hits zero.
You know, New York Times, though, it's trading pretty darn good, $50, give or take. I saw it earlier today.
Up or down?
It's been steadily going up. If you look at the chart over like the last year, 5 years, it's been steadily going up, surprisingly. Yeah. How does that happen?
I was told they were the failing New York Times. Anyway, let's get out of here.
They're not failing, man. According to the stock market, they're doing well, but who knows?
Good night, everybody. God bless. Len's still talking about the newspapers. I'll see you guys next week. Same time, same place. Until then, take care of yourself.
Take care.